journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, January 5th, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Hundreds of international activists attempt to enter Gaza to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the Israeli war. A rare conversation with an Iranian labor activist and what the ACLU thinks a fair airport security system looks like, plus Empire Notes. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A very happy new year to everyone and a very happy new decade to everyone. Iranians are continuing their uprising into the new year with ongoing street demonstrations. Last week, at least 8 people were killed in clashes with government forces and over a dozen people were arrested. On Sunday, the Shiite sacred day of Ashura, thousands of people demonstrated. Among those killed in recent weeks is Sayed Ali, the nephew of the opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi. The Iranian government has labeled dissenters anti-revolutionary terrorists and is resorting to severe crackdowns despite international condemnations by human rights groups and other governments. Many are characterizing the actions as a sign of the government's weakness. One of President Ahmadinejad's biggest fears is that the broad-based movement against him will use next month's celebration of the anniversary of the 1979 fall of the Shah as an expression of their dissent. An anonymous member of President Obama's administration told the New York Times that Iran's internal turmoil may be an opportune window to slap new sanctions over Iran's defiance on its nuclear program. But many social and political movements inside Iran that are intimately involved in the uprising are also wondering if the regime's days are numbered. Among them is Iranian Labor, a movement of underground labor organizers who've been strategizing underground for years, waiting for the right moment to demand workers' rights in public. I had the chance yesterday to speak with Humayun Porzad, who is an Iranian labor activist with the Network of Iranian Labor Unions. He's traveling under an assumed name in the United States currently. Andy Griggs also joined us. He's an LA public school teacher, an activist with UTLA, and a member of the steering committee of U.S. Labor Against the War. Let me start, Humayun, by asking you what your assessment is of the current resurgence, if you will, of activism in Iran after last summer. We started to see protests across the country erupt September through December. Most recently, there have been a lot of arrests and several reports by organizations talking about the torture of prisoners. How do you assess what's happening inside Iran?
Well, right now, this, I would say, is a kind of a historical juncture in that nobody expected a few months ago, let's say before summer, that there'd be such a huge popular movement and a government as powerful as the Iranian regime would be completely paralyzed by it. There is total disarray within the regime. They're not sure what course they should take. They don't know if they should, repress it, a la Tiananmen Square. They don't know whether they should come to compromise. In other words, there's total paralysis. And this is very promising because while these guys are completely racked by disunity, the popular democratic movement is getting stronger and gaining more support, judging by, the trajectory, if you follow it. And bear in mind that repression is quite heavy. So when you see tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people coming out, as happened last week, this is not under normal circumstances. They are taking considerable risk. They all know if they get arrested, they would be definitely tortured. Everybody's abused. and they may even get killed. So this goes to show the depth and the breadth of the movement.
Some are characterizing what's happening as a civil war.
No, I wouldn't call it a civil war by any means.
And others are saying it's a civil rights movement.
Well, it's basically a democratic movement. This movement has a minimal kind of a program where different people from different walks of life, different classes have joined together, including the labor movement. And its demands are very basic. They want an end to dictatorship as far as the kind of curtailment of civil and, human rights and the kind of police state that's been going on. And it started with the issue of the election fraud, but right now it's going beyond that. So, it's not civil war. It's just a very popular, I would say, powerful democratic movement. Mm.
What about the international context of what's happening in Iran right now? Because, of course, the Iranian regime wants to characterize all dissent as somehow being inspired by or controlled by the West. Meanwhile, Western governments and the international community are sort of watching with bated breath. But then there's also the issue of the nuclear program, the sanctions, the threats, relations with Europe and China. I mean, there's a lot going on externally as well. Does this just simply add to the Iranian regime's plate, if you will, and causes is maybe even weakening them as well?
Well, there's no question about it. Their maneuvering room has been drastically diminished in the last few months as far as their bargaining position, international negotiations and whatnot. But I think the more important question is what is going to happen to this democratic movement, because, by the way, this is a sort of grassroots democracy that we're seeing, and it may be a new model for the Middle East because it's not imposed from outside. The government is extremely eager to basically label the movement as foreign inspired, and I understand there's a lot of sort of a misconception here among many progressive groups. They think that just because Ahmadinejad raves and rants against Israel and the United States, he's supposed to be sort of some kind of anti-imperialist. We all think he's a demagogue, and this is just a fig leaf for their, great power politics and whatnot. Now, what's going to happen with the nuclear issue, nobody knows. But we're hoping that the pressure from outside is not going to give the government excuse, some kind of pretext to crack down, because on its own, this movement has been gaining a lot of ground, and it's basically beyond belief what it has achieved. This is how we see it. And it'd be really awful if the government could use some kind of a artificial excuse to put it down.
Humayun Porzad, you are a labor activist with the Network of Iranian Labor Unions. What are the challenges of organizing labor in Iran? I imagine that dissent is of any form is not tolerated even within organized labor.
No, it's not tolerated at all. According to the Iranian constitution, workers have legal protection to organize themselves into trade unions. But the government does not allow that. In fact, it's very, very repressive when it comes to labor, perhaps more than the other activities. And all labor organizing is underground. Those who are representatives of the movement have been arrested and tortured. The very least that could happen to a worker that supports organizing is to get fired. So unfortunately, right now, it's all underground.
And where do you work? What is your specific labor work? What does that involve?
Well, personally, I'm involved in the print shop workers union. That's basically where I have been working. But I'm also part of the network of Iranian labor unions, NILU, and we try to help out the labor movement with disseminating information about labor actions in Iran, perhaps in the world later on, and to help out with general guidelines such as what the legal rights are, what the health issues are, what kind of lessons some workers are learning, say, in one part of the country for the other part of the country. And other than coordinating this kind of sort of union organizing, we're trying to put out a national labor press. Those are the two main objectives we follow.
A labor press. Now, how does a union operate openly in Iran, if at all? I mean, isn't the point of a union to be able to bargain with your employer to get fair working conditions? But if you can't do it openly, then what can you do?
That's a very good question. No, you definitely cannot organize the workforce into labor organizations. But what you can do is you could build a nucleus of a labor organization in your workplace. But you could, as labor activists, you could help out with strikes and work stoppages and all kinds of things. Those go on extensively in Iran. And I may add that these conditions of the Iranian working class is at its, as is one of its worst in the last 100 years. Because the demand for labor power and for labor is much less than the supply. There's been a recession going on for 5 years ever since Ahmadinejad came. And we have a huge Afghan labor force that puts downward pressure on salaries.
Coming across the border.
That's correct. And all these have created a condition where the workers' bargaining position has weakened drastically. So it's much harder to go on strike. Still, practically every day, there are labor actions going on. So what the labor activists are doing are trying to help out with these labor actions and, you know, trying to target the most conscious workers for trade union activity, perhaps in later time when the situation is more propitious. Mm. So what you have right now are the nucleus of labor unions in various trades and in various industries.
I want to bring Andy Griggs into the conversation. Andy Griggs, you are on the steering committee with U.S. Labor Against the War. You've done a lot of organizing in solidarity with workers from Iraq. And you are here with Humayun Pourzad, who is an Iranian labor activist. What is the importance, you think, of American labor and Americans in general hearing from somebody like Humayun?
Well, I think it's so important that we know what's going on internationally, because often what is going on in other countries is reflected either by what we've done here or what has come there and has been done in other countries and then is visited in the U.S. U.S. Labor has often had this idea of solidarity on the international front, sometimes not so good solidarity with government unions and repressive regimes and through the State Department. But I think that's started to change, and whether it's work with the Iraqi oil workers, which we've done a lot of work with in terms of U.S. labor against the war, or solidarity with teachers in Mexico or around the world, I think it's very important that we are aware of what's going on and how we can be offer our solidarity and our support.
And it's interesting because Humayun brought up the issue of how progressive groups here in the United States often take a mistaken position. We don't have to live under Ahmadinejad, and as he is, since he is hostile to the U.S., some would say, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But when there is this solidarity on the ground, then you get a different perspective.
When you think about the ideas of the issues of work and the workplace are basically the same around the world, I think. I mean, obviously, specific conditions aren't. But the idea of having a family and a working family having health care and a place to live and a comfortable salary, it's so important. And so that kind of solidarity and the connections are there. And I mean, at a U.S. law convention where we had people from Pakistan, Iraq, from Canada, you know, coming to this meeting is an example of that kind of solidarity.
Going back to what's happening on the ground, Humayun, I want to ask you a little bit more about the state of Iran's economy and its workers in particular. You said that there's a recession right now like there is in so many other countries, and that, of course, does trickle down pretty seriously to workers. But what is the history of Iranian labor organizing been? I mean, is there a rich history? Can you tell our listeners who are probably ignorant like myself about this history what people like yourself have to draw on from the past?
Well, actually, the labor movement in Iran does have a long and proud history. Believe it or not, it goes back almost a century. There have been more or less three or four major waves of unionization in Iran. The first major one came after with the invasion of Iran by the Allies in World War II. And that basically came to an end with the 1953 coup. The second one was with the revolution in 1979, and it went on for about 5-6 years before that was also snuffed out. The latest one, in which we are operating under, is also very promising, although on the surface, you may not see a whole lot of activity, but much goes on under the ground. As I said, there's a lot of underground organizing going on. There's at least a dozen trade unions that are operating in Iran. There are two huge trade unions that have been suppressed, but they're still very popular with the workforce. There's the Tehran Bus Drivers Union and the sugarcane workers in southwestern Iran.
And when unions like this, when they do work stoppages, when they challenge the employer and the power structure, what is the reaction? And can you give us an example, maybe a recent example?
You know, it's not kind of black and white. A lot depends on who the local people are, who the local governor is, who the local police chief is, which faction they're with. And it also a lot depends on what tactics the workers use. If they overplay their hand, then they may be easily suppressed. Yet if they try to reach out to the to the community at large, let's say, or if they hire a lawyer, let's say, and he or she goes through the judicial system, there may be a lot of local gains. So it's a very, very nuanced kind of a thing. But in general, unionization is not tolerated at all. So you have to use other avenues. But as I said, there are many other avenues.
In terms of what we're seeing unfold, this nationwide uprising that we're seeing unfold, it seems as though if it does succeed, that could be a very important moment for Iranian labor.
Oh, no question. Yes, absolutely. To give you an example, about 6 years ago, the government of Khatami, the reformist president, basically signed his labor minister signed some covenants with the ILO, the International Labor Organization. And just because one of the clauses allowed for open and legal organization, that basically gave the impetus to a lot of organizing. Much of what we're doing today came from that. So you could imagine what happens one day if there is no police repression. You're going to see hundreds and hundreds of smaller unions and larger federations forming, I think, in very short time.
Finally, I want to bring Andy back into the conversation. Andy Griggs, tell us about the resolution that was just adopted this past December in Chicago by U.S. Labor against the war involving Iraq and Afghanistan, and how such a resolution or a similar resolution might be adapted to Iran, even though we're not sort of overtly and actively dropping bombs on Iran.
Well, first of all, I should say that about a year, may not have been the last resolution, but a year ago, when there was all the clamoring for war against Iran and, you know, the saber rattling, which is seems to be now ramping up again here in the U.S., U.S. law did have a statement that they put out about no expansion of the wars, whether it was into Afghanistan, Iran, and that kind of statement. And so we would, of course, be opposed to any kind of action in terms of that. The resolution that we did pass, of course, because it was right around the time that our president was going to make his statement, was that we call for an immediate end to the wars and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan and military attacks in Pakistan, and talked about the withdrawal, immediate withdrawal of all military forces and contractors, and the closing of all U.S. military bases. It's very interesting that in the past, U.S. labor against war started with the issues of Iraq, and we built up over the years by individual local unions building up. We eventually passed AFL-CIO to pass a resolution against the war in Iraq. But each time something new comes up, we have to then go back, because we are a coalition of groups, we have to go back to our locals and see what they're going to say. We can't, as an organization, just say, we're doing this. So we didn't have an official position on Afghanistan until December. December 6th, although most of the locals had taken resolutions, and that's what we brought together into this resolution that called for these changes, calling for full support of returning troops, the idea of participating in the March 20th events in a separate resolution, and also building and talking about the tie-ins and the connections with what's going on there and the economy in the U.S.
Where can listeners get a copy? Because this is a very lengthy resolution. Is there a website and any other information that you can give out?
Yes. U.S. Labor Against War has its resolutions that were just passed, and there are many. There are six of them at least that I can think of that were passed at www.uslaboragainstwar.org.
That's uslaboragainstwar.org. And finally, Humayun Porzad, you are also, as you mentioned, involved in efforts to put out a national labor press in Iran. How can people keep, get a hold of the efforts or online of Iranian labor?
Well, it's going to be bilingual.
I'm sorry, one second. Go ahead.
Yes, it's going to be bilingual website. IranLaborReport.com, www.IranLaborReport.com. You could send us emails to info@IranLaborReport.com. So I imagine in a few days, perhaps 4 or 5 days from now, you'd be able to go online and look at our website. It has coverage of labor news in Iran, labor analysis, also some updates on the political situation.
That's IranLaborReport.com and email at info@IranLaborReport.com. Humayun Porzad, best of luck to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you too, Andy Griggs. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
You've been listening to Andy Griggs, a member of the Steering Committee of U.S. Labor Against the War, and Humayun Porzad, an Iranian labor activist with a network of Iranian labor unions. And we list those websites on our site later today at kpfk.org/uprising. After today's Subversive Historian, we'll go live to Egypt, where many hundreds of people are still waiting to cross into Gaza. We'll also hear this week's Empire Notes, and a member of the ACLU will tell us why he thinks Americans have the right to be safe and free. Stay tuned.
Hello, I'm Don Bastani, one of KPFK's many volunteer programmers. I've been in broadcasting for a long time, with a lot of different radio and TV stations and networks, and not one of them is as free as KPFK. I love it that KPFK doesn't take contributions from big business and other special interests. No outside influence here. It's only because listeners like you support us that we can afford to tell it like it is. Join me Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock on Middle East in Focus.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on January 5th, 1968, Dr. Benjamin Spock, alongside four others, was indicted for conspiring to violate the Selective Services Act of 1948. The influential pediatrician was incredulously charged with aiding and abetting draft resistors. As a pacifist opposed to the Vietnam War, Spock's activist activities, including speeches he delivered, were held up as supposed evidence of his crime. As such, many saw the indictment as the first wave of a coming repression against domestic dissidents opposing the war machine. Spock found support among many, including Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who offered a statement of complicity with him and others indicted. As it turned out, Spock was found guilty, only to have his conviction overturned, however, on appeal. Conservatives reviled the good doctor's child-rearing philosophies, and it's easy to see why, as Spock himself said, quote, "I was proud of the youth who opposed the war in Vietnam because they were my babies." For Uprising, this is your truth professor. Is saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Egyptian authorities opened the Rafah border crossing into the Gaza Strip on Sunday, allowing only for permitted entries. The temporary move that expires tomorrow follows the denied entry last week of the vast majority of international activists who had gathered in Cairo to participate in the Gaza Freedom March. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry had previously cited a, quote, sensitive situation in closing the border to those seeking to meet up with Palestinian demonstrators on New Year's Eve in Gaza in the effort calling for the end of the Israeli siege of the territory. The march on the Israeli-Erez border was also set to commemorate the one-year anniversary of Israel's Operation Cast-Lead assault on Gaza. On Wednesday, an exception was made to allow entry for up to 100 international activists, and more than 80 delegates eventually crossed. The rest of the nearly 1,300 Gaza Freedom Marchers from over 40 countries remained in Cairo as solidarity demonstrations were held throughout the week. On New Year's Eve, hundreds of protesters, including many from the United States, were assaulted by plainclothes Egyptian security forces. Nevertheless, actions continued on New Year's Day outside the Israeli embassy in Cairo as the Gaza Freedom March issued a declaration calling on an end to Israeli apartheid. We go live to Egypt now. Joining us on the phone is Yvonne Lidley. She's one of the Gaza Freedom Marchers. Welcome to Uprising, Yvonne.
Hello.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. So first, let me ask you, who has been allowed to cross into Gaza and who has not? At what point do you think the Egyptian authorities are going to open the border up to everybody?
Hello?
Can you hear me, Yvonne? Hi, Yvonne. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Can you tell me who has been allowed to cross into Gaza and who has not?
Well, there were 1,400 Gaza Freedom Marchers trapped in Cairo for the last 10 days trying to get down to Gaza. None of us were allowed through. I think a handful or so representatives from Coast Pink joined a very small delegation down to and then to Gaza. But basically, the 1,400 Gaza Freedom Marchers were trapped in Cairo and were demonized by the Egyptian foreign minister, who called us bad Europeans, hooligans and hoodlums. And it has been extraordinary. We haven't been silent. We've campaigned. We've demonstrated. We've been at the end of some police violence. And those images have now gone around the world. And just today, we've taken part in an extraordinary class action with the Egyptian people, where we are taking the Cairo government to court to have the wall around Rafah stopped, this building of this wall to destroy the tunnels. So we've given power of attorney now to the Egyptian lawyers to act for us. I'm sorry, I'm in a very noisy street in Cairo, as you've probably gathered.
Yeah, that's fine. Can you tell us how long you and others will wait at the border? What if they don't let you in at all?
Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
How long will you plan to wait?
I think that the majority of the Gaza Freedom Marchers are now leaving Cairo, but we're handing over the baton of resistance to the Viva Palestina crew who arrived in Al Arish today. All of the convoy drivers and navigators and supporters have arrived in Al Arish, and they're ready to drive into Gaza, but once again, the Egyptian government is playing silly games and trying to stop a number of the vehicles from going through to Gaza. The Viva Palestina people have had a sit-in in the Al Arish airport in response to some of the games played by the Egyptian government. These people have been through hell and back over the last 4 weeks to get 250 vehicles carrying aid bound for Gaza, and right at the last hurdle, even now the Egyptian government is playing games.
And just for listeners, Viva Palestina is the effort led by George Galloway, the British parliamentarian who we've had on our program before. And he, along with his crew, are attempting to take supplies into Gaza. Well, finally, let me ask you, Yvonne, if you do make it into Gaza, what will you do there? And why are you there in the first place? What is your motivation?
I'm not sure that I heard the question right. I heard you mention George Galloway. He is leading this Viva Palestina convoy. He is in talks. As we're talking now, he's in delicate negotiations to get every single vehicle through into Gaza, which includes the American vehicles that were bought in the Viva Palestina, the second convoy, the American convoy. And I'm confident that with the negotiation skills that they will all get into Gaza. The bizarre thing is that if the Egyptian government had just let us all pass through, nobody would probably have heard of Gaza in the outside world. Nobody would have heard of the Gaza Freedom Marches or Viva Palestina. So in many ways, we have the crass stupidity of the Egyptian foreign minister Toussaint for shedding the spotlight on the plight of the Palestinian people on the anniversary of the brutal war in Gaza, in which more than 1,400 innocent Palestinians were slaughtered.
Well, finally, Yvonne, if you can hear me, I just want to know why you are there. What's your motivation to be in Egypt right now and try to get into Gaza?
Well, as I say, we've now handed the baton over to Viva Palestina. I'm sure that they will succeed. But trust me, the Gaza Freedom Marchers are not leaving Cairo with a heavy heart. because we've actually achieved more in terms of publicity for the plight of the Gazan people than we would have achieved had we been allowed to enter Gaza. It would have been a very minor media event, and instead the Egyptian government managed to turn the Gaza Freedom Marches case into a call for aid across the world, and enormous light on what is happening in Gaza. And the third thing is the Egyptian government is holding the siege of Gaza with more passion, more vigor, and more enthusiasm than the Israelis.
Well, Yvonne Lidley, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Best of luck to you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
And Yvonne Lidley is one of the Gaza Freedom Marchers who is, along with hundreds of others, who's been waiting for about 10 days at the border between Egypt and Gaza, attempting to get into Gaza to commemorate the one-year anniversary of Israel's Operation Cast Lead, the war 1 year ago that led eventually to the deaths of over 1,000 Palestinians. And you can find out more online at Gaza Freedom March.org. We'll also link that to our website later today at kpfk.org/uprising. This is Uprising, and after this week's Empire Notes, we'll speak with the ACLU about new airport security measures. Stay tuned. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by author and analyst Rahul Mahajan. Today's commentary is called Summing Up Obama.
In a recent New York Times piece, Adam Nagurny takes the liberal left to task for their anger at Obama over the sorry mess that health care reform legislation has become, suggesting that they should have understood from the beginning that Obama is someone who plays within the rules, even if they're an arbitrary set of conventions that grew up in a recent period of political and ideological retrenchment by liberals, who doesn't try to change the system but simply works with it, and that by this token, a health care bill that individually appeases every single player that could have blocked it, from the AMA to insurance companies to pharmaceutical companies to Max Baucus and Joe Lieberman, is what was always in the cards. Obama himself tried to suggest much the same by telling the Washington Post, quote, "I didn't campaign on the public option." Technically, he's correct. He talked about a lot of things like a public option as desirable, but he didn't promise he would deliver it. It's become fashionable to say that he has delivered everything he promised. He said he wanted to escalate in Afghanistan, and he's done it. He ran as an economic centrist, and he has delivered. But in every real sense, he has overtly turned his back on his promises. He built much of his campaign around a claim that politics in Washington is dysfunctional and needs to be shaken up. In this, of course, he's like every American politician for 200 years. But he differed in that he actually talked coherently about his vision of how to do that, and it was a vision that one simply doesn't hear from major presidential candidates. He was going to go over the heads of the politicians and the entrenched interests and try to build a mass movement. It was not going to be much of a mass movement, since there was supposed to be no ideological core. It was going to be held together by Obama's charisma and a bunch of vagueness about how much all of us normal people have in common. That last part was fatuous, though it's a fatuity that many of our left rabble-rousers share, and the whole program was ridiculously unworkable. How is a president going to anchor something like that without being excoriated by every opinion leader for playing politics with his office? But he said he was going to do it, and he didn't make the slightest motion toward lifting a finger to actually do it. He didn't even do the traditional bully pulpit thing on health care. Right from the beginning, he acted as if the only players in the game were in D.C., even though he had promised us he was going to change the game by bringing all of us into it, even if it was as a great undifferentiated mass. He also promised us, at least implicitly, that he was an original and independent thinker. That, plus of course his personal biography, was the only reason I had any interest in him. No president since FDR had been any such thing, and I thought it would be interesting to watch him try it out. I didn't think that he was anything but a moderate liberal politically. I had no illusions that he was some sort of stealth leftist, but I did expect that he would occasionally manifest insight. He has not. He made a couple of forays like his speech in Cairo, which, for all its flaws, was not something one would expect from an American president. And more subtly, he tried to signal to Latin America after the Honduran coup against Zelaya that the war on terror would no longer be used to refight the battles of the Cold War. You need only watch his backtracking on settlement in occupied Palestine or on restoration of Zelaya to see that at the first hint of resistance, he was happy to abandon all of his ideas. Indeed, as far as I can tell, Obama is passionate about only two things. The idea that reasonable people can always find technocratic solutions somewhere in the muddled middle, and that his personal biography is not just a matter of world historic import, but a profound moral principle. Interestingly, these are exactly the two passions that Hillary Clinton has, making one wonder once again why we wasted all that time following the primaries. For Empire Note, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Visit www.empirenotes.org for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. In the wake of the botched Christmas Day airline attack by a Nigerian man, the Obama administration is meeting with intelligence officials to understand how airport security failed. Already, new security measures have been put into place since yesterday that single out nationals from 14 specific countries, including Nigeria, Yemen, Afghanistan, and other majority Muslim countries. The Council of American Islamic Relations, or CAIR, countered that it considers the new measures religious profiling. Additional measures under consideration include improvements to the terror watch list, as well as new methods of full body scans and luggage searches. But the nation's leading civil liberties organization, ACLU, has called for the implementation of effective security policies that pose the most minimal threat possible to Americans' privacy. My guest is Chris Calabrese. He's a legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome to Uprising, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So as I mentioned, these new measures have been put into place just yesterday by the TSA, which is the private security company working with the government and Homeland Security. And can you first explain, as far as you know, why these particular 14 countries were singled out?
You know, it's not entirely clear. The most obvious explanation is simply that we think somehow that it's only Muslims that are terrorists. And if we get the Muslim-only countries, we'll be, you know, a long way towards, quote-unquote, finding the terrorists.
Well, I understand that part of the reasoning is that these are countries that include state sponsors of terrorism, but then also special interest countries. And I suppose that's the sort of vagueness that's troubling. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is troubling. I mean, I would even go so far as to call it un-American. I mean, we've spent the last 50 years trying to get away from the idea that we should be judging people's intention by the color of their skin or their religion or some other physical characteristic. And I think that's exactly what this is.
Well, the last time that that nationals from particular countries were officially singled out was in the immediate wake of the 9/11 attacks, when immigrants from a specific list of countries were called in for the so-called special registration. But then within a few months, that was eventually abandoned. Can you bring that into the context here?
Sure. I mean, that was specifically or generally referred to as NSEERs. And I think that there was an immediate realization that, of course, the vast majority of people who are Muslim or who are of any religion, race, are not only innocent, but, you know, actively working to help the United States. So if you take methods like forcing people to register or harassing them at the airports, what you do is turn at people who are actively friendly and helpful, and you alienate them from the United States and basically tell them that they are, in fact, suspects who need to fear the United States rather than people who can help you find the few radicals that do exist in any community.
Now, just playing devil's advocate, though, for somebody sitting on that Northwest flight, you know, might turn even the most raging liberal into an advocate of this kind of profiling, if only it means lives saved. How do you respond to the argument that, well, some people's discomfort may have to be the price that we pay for saving lives?
Well, I mean, I think that those people's actions, their heroic actions, demonstrate really exactly the opposite. They saw a specific threat. And I dare say that if that individual had been white or any other race or religion, and I suspect most of the people acting had no idea his race or religion, they would have acted in exactly the same way, seeing someone attempting to detonate a bomb. So, I mean, I think that that provides clarity to all of us. We should be judging people based on their actions, not their ethnicity. I mean, you can always find, for example, Richard Reed, the famous shoe bomber, was a UK national. You can always find a national of a country who's willing to commit terrible acts. The key is to find the specific individuals involved and to arrest them.
And by restricting this profiling to people who are citizens of particular countries, I suppose you can look at it the other way and say it leaves out those who may originally be from certain countries but who are now citizens of countries not on the list, say Americans or Canadians or British, but might be originally from a country that is on the list, if you will.
Sure. I mean, you can make a long list of people who've engaged in terrorist activities that are from quote-unquote friendly countries like the UK or Belgium or the United States. There is no one profile for a terrorist. There's no one path that people take to become a terrorist. And frankly, there are very few terrorists. So you can't find a particular model, point to it, and say that's how we'll catch the terrorists. And any broad screening mechanism that you employ is guaranteed to have many more false positives because there's many more innocent people than there are terrorists. And all of those false positives are people who will be harassed, treated like terrorists, and ultimately denied their rights.
Let's talk about some of the methods under consideration. Full body scans are one method that is being considered, and that is something that the people from nationals from this list of 14 countries could be subjected to soon. But it could also cast even a wider net. What exactly are full body scans?
Well, a full body scan uses either millimeter waves or X-rays to essentially create a detailed image of the human body.
X-rays?
Well, actually, yes, a type of backscatter X-ray. That's correct. There are two different types of technologies at work. And that is quite literally a detailed image. I mean, it shows genitalia. It shows things like colonoscopy bags, mastectomy scars. It's very graphic and it's very invasive. And I think people are rightly afraid that they're being subjected to a virtual strip search.
And how far along or how close is the government from actually implementing these kinds of scanners?
Oh, they're being implemented. The government just purchased 150 million of them, or excuse me, 150 of them over the last year, and plans to deploy them throughout airports and throughout the country. So they're actively being deployed.
And would they be basically, these would be, the body scans would be something that people who are going to be pulled aside for extra screening, that's what they're going to be subjected to at this point?
Well, it's very interesting. That was always the claim that TSA made, that, these were a secondary screening tool, that they were less invasive, for example, than a pat-down. But now that rationale seems to have gone by the wayside, and actually was going by the wayside even before this attack. And they were starting to say, well, we'll use these in place of metal detectors. We'll use them as the primary method of screening. And that, of course, is very invasive.
So in place of metal detectors, meaning everybody would walk through them,
right,
no matter who.
Exactly. Or at least everybody who went through that particular security checkpoint.
What about the issue of the terror watch list, Chris? This is something that that has been implemented and been shown to be faulty many times over the last 8 or 9 years or so. And the Obama administration is now looking to improve the so-called terror watch list. And this used to be something that airlines were expected to carry out when you checked in at the airport. If you were on a list, then they would pull you aside. What is the status of the so-called watch list?
Well, currently the watch lists are a mess. I mean, they're bloated. There's more than a million names associated with the terrorist watch list. And that's, and you know, and this attack really illustrates exactly the problem that that creates, which when you have a million names on the list, you get a lot of false positives, you get a lot of bad information, and it obscures potentially valuable and useful information, like the direct, you know, statements of the attacker's father, things that are what you would can only consider credible intelligence. Here we have these bloated lists, and they just obscure the useful information. I mean, the lists need to be vastly pared down so they, you know, don't implicate so many people. And there also needs to be a process for people to get themselves off the list, which there really is not now.
My guest is Chris Calabrese, legislative counsel with the ACLU. We're talking about what kind of airport security measures are being implemented at the government level. And now, Chris, what does the ACLU think are the fairest and yet, secure airport measures that your organization thinks could be placed? Because, of course, Americans want to be safe. I mean, and taking all of this out of context of the politics at hand here, narrowing our conversation for the ordinary person going through an airport, what is fair and safe?
Well, you know, the fact is that one of the most effective things you can do to combat terrorism is to catch these individuals before they get to the airport. And that means more law enforcement. It means good old-fashioned law enforcement. It means acting on credible information, finding people who are planning to commit crimes, which of course is in itself a crime, if you plan, and arresting them. That's basic police work, and that's the best way to keep people safe. I mean, we also support common sense screening measures. I mean, nobody wants to take metal detectors out of the airport. Nobody wants to stop random screenings that may catch people or, you know, may deter a terrorist.
As long as those random screenings are really random.
Right, exactly. As long as we're talking about real random screenings, which, by the way, are much more effective.
Why?
Because if you're a terrorist, you have no way of defeating a random screening. You have no way of predicting whether you're going to get randomly screened. However, if you know that the government instead is relying on a particular profile or a particular set of characteristics, you just make sure you don't meet that profile. You don't fit those characteristics, and you'll walk right through.
Chris, what recourse do Americans have at this point who are wary of what's about to be implemented, these full-body scanners, the expansion perhaps of this watch list, or at least not necessarily an improvement to this watch list? Can we do anything?
Well, I think we can. I mean, I think this is a critical moment in Congress. I mean, the discussion is really just beginning. These machines are very expensive, for example, the whole-body imagers. It's not a matter of simply waving a magic wand and saying, we want these in all the airports. They're expensive, they're invasive, and I think there's going to be a debate. So to the extent that folks can talk to their congresspeople, say that they don't want to be they don't want these whole-body images. Of course, the ACLU has an action. If you'd like to go to the ACLU's website, you can find a way to contact your congressperson directly.
And that website is?
And that website is www.aclu.org, and you'll find a direct link to our travel security.
That's aclu.org. Okay,
ACLU,
go ahead.
aclu.org. And, you know, it's a similar discussion with the watch list. I mean, we have been saying, and this is a discussion that goes both to the executive branch, the president, and Congress, and it's, you know, we need to pare down these lists. They're too big, and there's no due process for getting off them. And that's something that simply has to be changed by law.
And just on the watch list briefly, is there anything in these lists that accounts for several people having the same name? I mean, is it just a database of names devoid of any other characterizing information, or is it names plus other detailed information like passport and a number or other things?
It really varies depending on the individual. It's not just name. There is as much identifying information as they both have and feel appropriate to share. And so they do make an effort to narrow it down, but the lists themselves are very big, and hence you're going to get a lot of false positives just because of that. But I think maybe more scary to individuals, we're talking about a million names here. So there's a lot of people on this list who are purposely put on this list but just shouldn't be there.
And they may not even know they're on the list until
they
travel.
Almost don't. That's right.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Chris Calabrese is a legislative counsel with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. You can find out more about their airport security measures alert at aclu.org. And by the way, we will list this and all other websites that we mentioned on the show on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. And if you are interested in joining our daily digest, we have an email list that you can sign on to. And every day after the show, we'll email you the details of the day's shows along with direct links to the websites as well as any local event information that we have may have listed on that show. It's a great way to keep in touch with the things that you hear on the program, and you can check out kpfk.org/uprising to sign up for that list. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, Dorothy Thompson once said, "It is not the fact of liberty, but the way in which liberty is exercised that ultimately determines whether liberty itself survives." That's Dorothy Thompson, and that's Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer, and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. today on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8. To